Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin, and thrilled today to be joined again, but it's been a little bit. By Harvey Kronberg, publisher of the Quorum Report, publisher, co-owner, guiding spirit of the Quorum Report, one of the most widely read insider news services in Texas politics. You know, if Josh was here, we'd talk about, you know, it's a Quorum Report is what we would call endogenous to the system, right? You're not really reporting from the outside. You're reporting from the inside, and we'll talk about that more. So thanks for joining us after a busy weekend of travel. You were in our nation's capital.
It's true. I was in Washington, D.C. A friend of mine had created the D.C. Jazz Festival. He passed away last fall, so they were having a celebration of his life, and I was one of the two people invited to eulogize him. So I'm grateful that it didn't happen right after he passed because everybody was grief-stricken. This turned out to be a true celebration, and jazz musicians flew in from as far away as South Africa to perform.
Oh, that's terrific.
Yep. That's pretty terrific. Amazing. Pretty amazing that day.
Well, I know you had a long relationship with him. I'm sorry for the passing, but that's a great way to pay tribute.
Absolutely. And what a legacy. He produced an Emmy Award-winning TV documentary on the 40th anniversary of the creation of the State of Israel with Paul Simon, Roberta Flack, Barbara Streisand, among the many high points of his career. But the D.C. Jazz Festival is going to be the legacy.
And tell us your friend's name.
Charlie Fishman.
So you can look some of that up, I bet, out there. But there's, you know, in this day and age where nothing really gets lost, I'm hoping that there's a lot of stuff out there from those festivals. Well, I appreciate it. You just got back yesterday, so we appreciate you making it in. It's
absolutely my pleasure.
There's a lot going on. So, you know, let's dig into it. Let's just start from, yeah, maybe not quite 40,000 feet, but let's just talk with our general view of what's going on at the legislature right now. I'm not going to go to you with the dreaded "how many sessions is this for you" question. we'll stipulate it's a lot. Going back into the, you know, the previous age of Texas politics, shall we say?
Let's just say I was booted out of or disinvited to Ann Richards' Christmas press parties, and the tradition is maintained through subsequent governors, except for George W.
Fair enough. So let's start with like agenda. It looks to me, allowing for the inherent contingency of the process, et cetera, but it looks to me that when we look at what's moving in the legislature, where we started with the signaling agenda-wise, that most of the major players, including the governor, are getting so far more or less what they want. That makes sense to you? I mean,
absolutely correct. Now, the governor may not have been able to move the ball by himself on his most significant piece of legislation. It required the president to actually speak to the Republican caucus to move some votes, but it was successful. We're obviously talking about his you can call them vouchers or scholarships, education scholarships, either one. But that was the key piece of his agenda this session that had to pass.
I was curious when, you know, we saw, I think it was Scott Braddock wrote the piece on Quorum Report, making that argument that basically they needed the Trump push, or that the Trump push got them the extra votes. Tell me a little more about the theory of the case there.
Well, the core of the issue is that the governor is selling something that probably is not going to prove to be true, which is that this is not going to steal from public education. And you have some pretty serious Republican Republican proponents for public education, particularly in rural districts where schools are the epicenter of the economy and the community. And so there was pretty hard resistance. The governor went out during the primary, the Republican primary, and I don't use this word. As a matter of fact, I've never used this word in referring to a Texas politician, but he deliberately lied about 18 Republican incumbents, claiming that this election was he was campaigning against them because of their position. They were weak-kneed on the border. Of course, the truth is that some of them actually carried his border legislation, and none of them ever voted against anything that he proposed on the border. So from my perspective, the truth is always the first casualty in a political campaign, but I've never seen a governor go out and deliberately try and destroy the Republican caucus, replace it with a bunch of newbies. And I don't think the rural Republicans understand the voice they lost in the legislature with all the seniority that they lost and all the experience they lost. What typically happens with a freshman is they have a really narrow field of vision. They think they represent an ideology more than a district. And it usually takes two or three sessions before they really connect with their district in a meaningful way. And so you've got a bunch of novice legislators representing rural districts. But the governor ultimately prevailed. But even after having committed this violence on the Republican caucus, it was not clear that he had the numbers. There was a strong movement in the House that I do believe had probably 80 votes or so to try and send this to the people with a referendum. Don't know if that would have flown in the Senate or if the governor would have accepted, but that was...
Seems pretty unlikely, right?
But that was the next line of defense and the only line of defense for those who opposed the vouchers.
So, but the Trump call was, I'm trying to remember the timing of this. Trump call was the morning of, and so it came.
Yes.
So the thesis is that helped tamp down the less politically courageous alternative, shall we say.
a master of the vocabulary. Well, the caucus meets in the Ag Museum, which I think is the only room in the entire building that does not have video.
Right.
And so whenever something is happening in the Ag Room, it's of particular interest. And of course, reporters and press will be congregated outside. And there's a little history to that. The last time the governor met with the caucus was like that to encourage them was in his first or second session when he was endorsing pre-K and funding for pre-K. And the Republican hard right said that rebelled, saying it was brainwashing, it was socialism, it was indoctrination. And so he told his Republicans at the time that if they stuck with him on this gut check vote, he would be there for them in the primary. Well, they performed. He did not. And not one of them. One East Texas state rep said he had been rejected when he requested an endorsement, an outright endorsement. And then 2 hours later, Abbott's fundraiser called, wanting to see if he would co-host a fundraiser in the district. So, yeah, a little bit of tone deafness as far as the legislature goes. But in this case, the same kind of thing happened. It was a morning meeting before the vote. And I don't think that Abbott by himself would have been persuasive. But I think the surprise and the fact that among Republican primary voters, the president still has high numbers, even if his other numbers are sinking.
Yeah, and we'll see how much they're sinking soon, I hope. Obviously, Trump doing that helped. I mean, there's no two. So, you know, we're splitting hairs here a little bit. But I do wonder, you know, it seems to me that the impact of that call was not so much to put him over the line as it was, or it helped put him over the line, but it also moved votes that they didn't necessarily need, right? And that seems like, you know, there were four or five votes that seemed to be in question.
Right.
Including some veteran lawmakers, you know, Charlie Guerin would be an example of that.
Right, who has historically voted against
vouchers. And then wound up throwing the lot. I think only two Republicans voted against the bill, right? Is that right?
Well, I think it was just one, actually.
Just one.
I think it was the former speaker, Dave Phelan.
That's right. I'm confusing that with the other vote. so, you know, I'm just wondering how overdetermined this was already. And I say that not to disagree with the interpretation. Like I said, it undoubtedly helped, right? But I mean, I think the other thing that's curious about this is that, well, I think it seems fair to speculate that they turned a few votes, a few more of those final four or five that they got in the last day, really. But it also seems like, to go back to your previous characterization of the governor's efforts in the primary, you know, this was already pretty determined. Yeah. I mean, it feels to me that the governor has intimidated a lot of members of the Republican House. I mean, not to just put too sharp a point on.
Well,
and intimidated sounds like I mean bullying, but it's just, you know, he played hardball politics,
yes.
And, you know, it worked.
But I would argue two things that to potentially counter that in regards to the primary. First is Greg Abbott has been historically underwater in polling. I'm speaking to a pollster, so you may dispute me on this, but generally he's been underwater and has been always very much afraid of the hard right in his party. Second, I don't know, when he started shipping undocumented folks up to Martha's Vineyard, his approval number surged. He was at the peak of his popularity, probably throughout the highest point in his entire career as governor. Speaking to a pollster, but generally speaking, I think that to be accurate.
It was good. His numbers did not suffer, to say the least.
Yeah. So he was at the peak of his popularity, and then outside money came in and put $6 million into the effort, which allowed them to do saturation bombing on TV, and then another $4 million. And so $10 million in 18 Republican primaries, including rural primaries, is pretty overwhelming. And I don't know that he would have been able to. He would have been as successful had they not had that kind of saturation bombing. Most of these members, as I say frequently, they're going to lie about you in a campaign anyway, so you might as well represent your district. And most of these members had a long history of successfully representing their district and were well thought of. But when the governor comes in and says you're weak on the border, which is the number one issue among Republicans,
especially primary voters,
yes, yeah. It's devastating and proved to be so.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess that's kind of the point I'm making, right, is that, you know, there's a certain amount of, you know, regular beatings have been applied. and, you know, intermittent reinforcement.
Yes, sir. May I have another?
Somebody I'm close to, you know, tends to have a very positive, has an affirmative effect, shall
yes.
we say. Well, so what else? I mean, so there's that. Looks like the, you know, the property taxing, there are issues to be ironed out, but all pretty divisible one, you know,
yeah, but,
matters that are pretty divisible.
There's interesting, you know, side effects on the property taxes, but yeah, I don't see that as a meltdown kind of issue. And the central character in this session, frankly, is the speaker, Dustin Burrows. He's a new speaker, and the first duty of a speaker is to protect their members and particularly their party's incumbents. And he has successfully so far navigated some really hard votes that would, again, or avoided some really hard votes that would damage his Republicans. He's the first speaker not to have been elected with the majority of his caucus, first trial lawyer Republican speaker, first speaker to be elected under the shroud of scandal. He was the one who identified the 10 Republicans that they wanted primaried and tried to work a deal out with Michael Quinn Sullivan of Empower Texans. And so he came in with a lot of question marks about his ability. But so far, he's done a pretty reasonable job. And ironically, one of the least liked Republican members moved to vacate the chair, to remove the speaker from the chair. And he only got two votes, which at least symbolically consolidated Speaker Burrow's a hold over the House.
And well, I wanted to talk about that, so let's just do that. So I think an interesting part of that puzzle, as we talk about where things stand now in late April, is that, you know, things look on the surface anyway, and I think it's sometimes surface impressions are right, that, you know, one of the big through lines of the last session was the ongoing cage match between Lieutenant Governor Patrick, then Speaker Dade Phelan. There seems to be much more alignment this time, despite the fact that the Lieutenant Governor was not a Burroughs supporter going into this.
He was actually advocating for his opponent.
Yes. Again, understatement being the theme of the day. but even given all that, despite the occasional shot across the bow and threatening gesture here and there, there's a lot more alignment between the big three for various kinds of. Is that a fair read? And
yes,
what do you think that's about?
Well, I think that there's a lot of incentive for Burrows to find accommodation, whereas Phelan got insulted and Joe Strauss was at a roast for one of the members, said, you know, I'm really kind of angry at Dade Phelan. It took me four sessions before the lieutenant governor called me the worst speaker in Texas history, and it only took him one. So, but the secret sauce, not to take anything away from the speaker, is that he brought in Robert Duncan as his chief of staff. Robert Duncan is a former, I like to say, staffer for Senator John Monford. He was a former House member, former senator, former chancellor of Texas Tech. Enormous amount of experience, known as a very thorough and somewhat intimidating negotiator. And most importantly, he served with Patrick. And so I think that a lot of what they have done has been designed. Actually, if you go back and look at the committee assignments, a lot of those committee assignments were designed, in my opinion, for the conference committees for consequential legislation, which is how it should be, instead of just kind of throwing committees together and then seeing what happens and then, you know, having weaker folks man consequential conference committees.
You know, Dade Phelan did a talk here early in the session, did an interview on stage thing with Evan Smith at the LBJ school, and I went over there. And, you know, my question to him was, looking back on all of that, what were, you know, what kind of, yes, what the recent unpleasantness, what kind of, you know, were there decisions that he thought he would have done differently? You know, the kind of, what'd you learn from this experience in retrospect, looking mm-hmm. back on it? And he said, you know, it's not any of the big decisions. I don't regret any of the big decisions. And I think by that, obviously, the elephant in the room is the Paxton impeachment.
Correct.
But he did say that he thought that you make a lot of small decisions at the time that in retrospect you look back on, and they were big decisions that had consequences you didn't quite see. And his example was committee appointments.
Mm-hmm. Well, he didn't really build a team, and one of the great criticisms for Speaker Phelan was that he didn't have any gray beards or gray hairs in the back room, people with long experience, he didn't incorporate on his team senior Republicans on the floor. His inner circle was what came to be known as the frat boy caucus. You know, four or five term members, responsible, but didn't see the chessboard in a big fashion. And he was inaccessible to some of his members. I know one member that sought a meeting with him for 3 months and kept getting postponed and never did get the meeting. You can't build a coherent structure with that kind of absence of organization.
People remember those things.
Yes.
Right. The member that couldn't get the meeting.
Exactly. I mean,
that because those stories become they take on an almost emblematic nature. So it feels to me like what we're dancing around is that there's, on one hand, there's an alignment of interests here. I mean, and I take your point, and I think, you know, certainly people in the building feel this way, that the way that Speaker Burroughs has approached hiring, organization, committee strategy is an improvement, right?
Yes.
But I think, you know, in addition to that, there is a little bit more of an alignment of strategy here. I think you used the term incentive. Maybe it was just going through my head. But it does seem that it's not so much, you know, the underlying sources of conflict aren't there. Some of them have been removed to the degree that the Phelan-Patrick fight was, you know, presented as ideological, and there was an element of that, but it was very personality driven.
Yes.
Here, I mean, what everybody has more of an incentive, I think, to sublimate the conflicts that are there.
Well, Patrick is the ultimate alpha dog and does not brook rebellion in any form or fashion. And
impertinence.
And he was, yes, he was trying to impose his will on the House by essentially electing a surrogate speaker for him, although, with all due respect to David Cook, I don't think he saw that as his role, but he certainly was perceived by that as by the members and by folks like us that observe it. But it's the entire tone is different. They resumed breakfast, and again, Duncan has served with Patrick as a senator. He left before he became lieutenant governor, as I recall. But that level of interaction and experience, frankly, is irreplaceable.
Right, especially under the circumstances. Right, I mean, given, you know, talking about one of the things that's being sublimated here is just, you know, the wildness of the conflict between the House and the Senate last time.
It seems to be pretty exclusively inside the House.
Yeah, that I think so. Let's talk about that. So I want to talk about that because I have a, you know, you're in, you know, I always think of you. I always think of you, period. How's that? I always think of you as somebody very, you know, I mean, I think in this age of people saying, branding you ideologically, I think of you as more institutionally aligned in terms of your interests and what you think is, you know, frankly, right and wrong about anything is happening, things that are happening at a given time in the political
system. We honor process. I can accommodate policy.
So given that, I'm curious what you make of the fact that many of those who voted for Cook rather than Dustin Burroughs did so under the banner, which I think, and I guess this is my question, I've come to take more seriously than I might have in the beginning, and that is that they see themselves as reformers of how the institution operates. And in talking to some of those folks now, I'm still picking that up. In other words, they're still not really satisfied, I don't think, with the level of transparency, with the operation of the rules. And I think for me, it can be difficult to tease out where the interests and where the principle are. But to be honest, I've come along to a point where I think I take the argument of the reformers as looking for institutional reform, even allowing for the fact that they think it will suit their agenda better, which, you know, we're all adults here. I'm just wondering how you think of that. I mean, do you just set that reform argument aside? Do you think it, do you take it seriously? How do you parse that out? Given that, you know, I would almost think of you as being a little bit amenable to some of the arguments.
Actually true. And I'm not going to say that they haven't torqued the rules on a handful of occasions. The speaker hasn't. He has torqued the rules. For instance, on the opening day, the rules debate, they called the previous question to stop debate prematurely. That's kind of a nuclear option, and rarely does it ever happen before the end of the session. And now it's a predicate. It's something that anybody could invoke. And it taught them, it ticked off a lot of people that they cut off the debate on the rules.
Yeah.
It also taught them that moving the previous question is a privileged motion that can, you know, effectively silence whatever your opposition is. That's not a good thing.
Yeah.
We've got a large freshman class, both Democrats and Republicans. The Republicans are more outspoken in terms of reform, but there's always impatience among freshmen. And the level of intimidation, well, let's put it this way. The lieutenant governor probably has the singularly loudest voice among Republican primary voters. And nobody wants to get crosswise with the lieutenant governor. He's notorious for... He liked this line, even though he says he doesn't read me. he's notorious for taking legislative hostages and particularly enjoys shooting the hostages, which means your bills could get vetoed if you cross him, et cetera. So there was a certain level of intimidation implicit in the fact that he was endorsing David Cook. But yes, I think there is a legitimate concern. There's been a few other games like that in terms of messing with the rules. But by and large, my sense is that folks feel like the parliamentary rulings have been pretty much on the up and up, and nobody has gotten truly torqued about parliamentary rulings, which is kind of how you take the temperature of the institution.
I think as we get closer to the end, that'll be the real test, though, right? I mean, because that's where the stakes get higher. And tempers get shorter. And you know, I mean, I this is not a systematic analysis, but to my memory, where we tend to see the most debate and questions about the execution of the rules fairly is in the last few weeks, if not the last few days, right? Certainly in the last few weeks.
I like to say that we're now entering that period, the home stretch of the legislative session, when they make their most important decisions. They're dehydrated, over-caffeinated, sleep-deprived, and living on queso and vodka.
And a little...
Good policy-making formula there.
A little crankier and maybe a little more impulsive. I want to go back and hit on something that you mentioned earlier, and that is this piece about how you talked about the hostage taking by the lieutenant governor. It seems to me we have a couple of potential hostage taking situations going on here right now. So since you raised the lieutenant governor, let's start with that. And I'm just going to put it bluntly, how serious do you think his sort of nuclear option special session threat was in regard to the THC regulation, cannabinoid regulation?
Make idle threats, so he, but the material that would compel, the way he said it implied that he could call a special session or he could manufacture the need for a special session. But there were only two signature
issues. I think he would say, of course, I know that. That's right. Not the case. But anyway.
But for civilians out there, they may not know that, but it's certainly inside.
No, I think that's a very fair point.
We divide the world between civilians and combatants, and the civilians don't know. But the only two issues that on the surface, it looks like would compel the governor to call a special is his signature issue, which was vouchers. And by the way, the fact that the Senate decided to concur and not go to a conference committee tells you how fragile that and how potentially temporal that coalition was that ultimately passed the voucher bill.
Well, I think that and in balance with that, just how badly they want to move that.
Right. But had that failed in any significant fashion, that would have compelled a special session and the budget. And the budget is not, they're not very far apart on the budgetary issues. Now, having said that, what may compel a special session has nothing to do with Dan Patrick, and that is the fact that the Democrats now, feeling like they got rolled in the voucher vote, have decided to essentially block. Their only real leverage is there's things, constitutional amendments, and more importantly, busting budget caps that need 100 votes, that need two-thirds of the House. And they have enough members to essentially stop all constitutional amendments. And we are going to have to bust the budget caps based on the spending that we're doing, and that's going to require Democratic engagement. And the Democrats, ironically, could push us into a special session, not the lieutenant governor. But one more thing about the THC, which is really interesting.
No, I wanted to go back to the whole THC because we didn't really, because I find it hard. If the lieutenant governor has more or less everything else he wants, I find it hard to imagine that despite the point you made about his, determination, shall we say, that he would try to maneuver a special session just because of that. It seems to me he's going to be pretty open to a compromise on what that legislation ultimately looks like.
I promise you, we're not going to recriminalize THC. There's no appetite for that in the House. But to me, the politically interesting thing is pretty much every poll of Republicans, and I'll ask you for confirmation, suggests that 70% support, these are primary voters, but support regulation, but do not support criminalization or an outright ban.
Yeah, we haven't asked it that way, that's not inconsistent with what we've seen. What we have seen is a little bit of a retrenchment in opposition, I think. But it's still, there's still not a consensus, nowhere near a consensus on moving much more in a criminalization direction.
Right. And Twitter or X, whichever you want to call it, is not a barometer of much that's worthwhile, but it is a barometer Republican, it's kind of a town hall meeting for Republican primary voters. And whenever Patrick would post something, generally speaking, he's got a big fan club and they'll all rally around saying, well, it's the Democrats' fault or whatever the mantra du jour is. But if you follow him these days, when he posts something on Twitter, he's essentially getting flamed by his base and it always comes back to THC. I have never seen Dan Patrick has the best political antenna in the process, and he's constantly polling, and he knows what the polling is saying. And I've never seen him so separate from his base. So
I think this is one of those issues where he has views of it, and I've heard this from some advocates involved in this, and that he will acknowledge what the polling says and sort of say, I still think it's wrong.
Right. So one of the interesting things he's doing is threatening lobbyists that have THC or cannabis clients with destroying the the rest of their packages they're trying to promote for other clients, which is, again, hardball politics, might be a little bit over the line, well, maybe a lot over the line, but certainly not new in Texas politics. But
right. I mean, not unheard of.
Yes.
Let's go. I want to go back and close out on the white light strategy because, I mean, the way you describe that kind of answers a question I've had, which is, you know, if the narrative that this strategy emerged in response to how they felt, how Democrats or leadership among Democrats felt about the voucher vote and how that all unfolded and the, you know, all of that. Mm-hmm. It kind of has left me wondering, but what is the end game?
Bingo. That's the $64,000 question.
You know, because if the end game is bargaining space in the budget to bust the cap, you know, I guess if I tilt my head a little bit sideways, I guess I can see that. You know, in the sense of, you know, but it really is going to depend who's going to get what out of that.
Right. And we don't, there is, it kind of feels like Trump on tariffs. We don't know what the point is. Yeah. And I doubt that they're going to hold that white light strategy on things like property tax reduction.
Well, that, I mean,
but
that's been my other question about this all along. Are you really going to go on the record as Democrats in the House obstructing the property tax cuts? You know, some people in some districts can more or less get away with that. But whether you can hold enough votes to do that, I think, is difficult at least.
Yeah. The budget cap, though, does create some negotiating room.
Well, right, because it's just, you know, it's inherently distributive and transactional.
Yes.
Right.
And interestingly, we may be setting ourselves up. We'll talk about this in a minute, but for a severe budget cutting session coming up, just because.
Well, let's just move into that. I think that's, you know, we were talking about that before. We did a podcast on this. Josh and I think talked about this based on a piece. But, you know, as we were getting ready, you were raising, and then there's the whole matter of the economy. I think I'll let you use your term of choice, but there are big questions about whether we're in the last moments of a budgetary environment that is going to change dramatically. That would be my anticipation.
Cutting session since 2011. We've had surpluses every session since 2011. There's only 6 senators and 18 House members that were here in 2011. Only about 25% of our budget's discretionary. They have no idea what the pain that a budget cutting session can inflict. And just to toss a couple of numbers out there, consumers are retrenching and pulling back right now. A portion of our population has gone underground. Even just green card holders are being more tentative. 50-some-odd percent of our revenues come from sales tax. And March was the first month, I think, in 10 years that we did not have year-over-year increases in sales tax. Just to pick one industry, forget agriculture, which is enormous, but one industry, we've got probably 1,700 auto assembly lines in the state of Texas that require just-in-time parts from Mexico. And some of those parts move back and forth. So, and I can't find an answer from anybody that lobbies for any of the auto manufacturers as to, do you get tariffed each time it goes back and forth? You get tariffed once. Any way you look at it, there's going to be massive friction. And on top of that, you may have seen one of the things I don't think the budget writers are thinking about, they're getting ready to spend an enormous amount of money. The president yesterday declined to send federal emergency FEMA support to Arkansas after a series of tornadoes, a rock-ribbed red district, and specifically wants to move disaster relief to the states. Well, Texas is one of the most disaster-prone states in the country, and the nobody has put together a number for me yet that reflects the amount of federal emergency money we've received in a 2-year budget cycle. But that's a huge hole, potentially a huge hole. If they they eliminate the Department of Education, there's the promise that we'll get the same funding but without the strings. But that's $8 billion, and on it goes. So. Pretty much everywhere you look is there's some kind of a circuit. Oh, and one other thing, Walmart and Target and Home Depot met with the president the other day and informed him that in about 2 to 4 weeks, we're going to start seeing empty shelves in the big box stores because there's like virtually all shipments from China have stopped. And yeah. Even if they started today, it would take 3 weeks for them to start arriving. If the big box stores start having empty shelves, you get consumer dissatisfaction, and that's ultimately going to lead to layoffs. Anyway, any way you look at it, it's a potentially cascading disaster for Texas for the Texas economy. And again, we have perceived a sense of we have a sense of entitlement over budget surpluses. And this session, the lieutenant governor wants to eliminate the lottery. That's what, $3 or $4 billion. We'll make it up in growth. Well, maybe not this time. So.
Yeah, I mean, I think the days of assuming that level. I mean, they're already over.
Yes.
Right. I mean, based on what we've seen, and there, it's not likely to get better. There's an interesting dynamic, and I understand this. I mean, all of that is down the road. Nobody wants to, you know, put it too bluntly. Nobody wants to think about the future right now.
Well, once you...
You know, they want to get through the near, you know, that the future right now is the next 50 days or so, 50 or 60 days counting veto periods, and, you know. But no, I mean, I've been struck by that. And I think we'll see some interesting leading indicators because as I understand the process, when the budget is settled, at least in legislative terms, it still has to be certified again by the controller. And I think there's probably enough margin that it's not like the whole thing's going to break, but it's going to be very interesting to see what the leading in, you know, what the updated figures in that revenue estimate used to certify the budget are going to look like, because it's going to be our chance to see how the controller's office is adjusting the projections. And if you look at the past, I mean, you get new numbers when they certify the budget. There's another analysis that gets done.
Yes.
And this will be done by a controller who is on his way out and is not running for office again.
To his credit, in the initial revenue estimate at the beginning of the session, he put $1 billion as of wiggle room in his estimate. So they have some wiggle room. But if the Trump policies prevail for the next 3 or 4 months, we probably aren't going to see the kind of declines that he'll have to reconcile on his certification.
Yeah, right. That's the big question in my head is just how... You know, there are a lot of different ways that those assumptions can be broken there. And there is a lot of room right now to say, you know, I'm not saying this is how long this is going to last. This is what's plausible at this moment in late May or early June. Period.
And we haven't even mentioned the oil patch,
right,
which is a major contributor to the Texas surplus. And Bloomberg had a story last week that the dropping prices of oil, while that may be one of the president's goals, has been devastating the oil patch, and there's already layoffs. Maybe not so much yet in the Permian, but across the oil patch nationally.
Yeah.
That's just another input that is going to be in our face, and we gain the Permian works at $60 a barrel. Under $60 a barrel, it doesn't.
And, right. I haven't checked today, but in the last week or so, it's been in the range of between 60 and about 62, I
correct,
think, 63 maybe.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things I was sort of flagging a couple of weeks ago. I want to talk to you a little bit about Quorum Report and media, but I want to end with one last shot at the overall scope that takes advantage of your longevity and wisdom.
Nicely put.
You know, We've talked a lot about things, you know, implicitly in this conversation, you know, some things that are a matter of continuity, some things that seem new or, you know, to be developing in the legislature, in the political system overall. I think it's, there's a real temptation, particularly as things have become more polarized, for folks like us to emphasize the discontinuity and to emphasize, oh, it's all changing, right? And I hear this, you know, it's already come up in here once, the sense that place is just not working the way it used to.
Right.
You know, a lot of senses that, you know, and I can't figure out what the combination of shifts in standard operating procedure and shifts in vibes, you know, so what's your sense? I mean, you know, in the law, you know, how much have things changed in some fundamental institutional way? What's the balance between continuity and change? Just setting aside the biggest change that, of course, was the partisan change. But we're now 25 years, depending on when you want to start it, 30 years into that. What's your sense? When you walk into the building now,
we have become,
is it still recognizable? Is it, you know, what's recognizable and what's not, I guess, to you?
The great beauty and the great thrill of being involved in Texas politics was a sense of power sharing. And you're talking about the partisanship, but the bottom line was that there was always, when the Republicans were in the minority, they might disagree a little bit in terms of being abused by Democrats. But by and large, we had three parties. Then we had conservative Republicans, moderate Republicans, and then Democrats. And now it's and there was an impulse towards consensus rather than confrontation. It feels now more like that confrontation is the order of the day. And most particularly, there was a great pleasure in the fact that we weren't like Washington. We had committee chairmen from both parties in both chambers. That's gone. Former Speaker Pete Laney said anybody that votes because of the instruction from the caucus is brain dead and not representing their district. I might have said it a little differently than he did, but yeah. The caucuses now are far more consequential than they were 15 years ago. And caucuses, what the Republicans want to do is a majority of the caucus would pick the speaker, and then the rest of the caucus would have to follow along. That just means, you know, if you've got we've got 86 Republicans, that would mean 44 Republicans would pick the speaker. We haven't gone quite that far yet, but we are on that trajectory. And that is, I think it's a recipe for disaster because we only meet for 5 months every 2 years. We don't really have time to screw around the way Congress does. We have to make decisions. Mostly they're incremental decisions, but we have to make policy decisions. And this demonization of right now, predominantly Republicans demonizing Democrats, but that's only
some Republicans demonizing other Republicans.
Exactly.
On the edges of that, policing the boundaries.
Yeah. Right. And Democrats don't have a loud enough voice at this stage to demonize. But the other thing that could be significant, it's just to say the last midterm that he had, we're a state of 31 million people. We have the only election that matters in most cases is the Republican primary, which peaks out at about 3 million out of 31 million. But it's typically about 1.6 million, which is another way of saying 800,000 people control the policy directions of the state. And so that creates an environment that you're not worried about the other side. You're always looking over your shoulder. You may think you're right, but there's somebody further right that's coming after you. And there's a lot of outside money that gets to play in things like the speaker's race that was not doable previously. I guess the sense of it is that consensus is being devalued and caucuses are being elevated in importance. And the primary voters have come to expect that. But as I started to say, President Trump in his Trump 1.0 midterm, it was a referendum on him. And that made November consequential, where it normally isn't consequential. If he stays on this trajectory, I mean, he's already got as of this week, virtually every poll has him at historically low levels and really crashing and burning on the economy. Even among Republicans, you're seeing erosion. Democrats may prove to be incapable of capitalizing on it, but I don't think that they're not even part of the conversation. It's going to be an up or down vote party-wise based on the president's performance. And that is one of the potentially good things that could happen, is that November becomes a relevant election again, as opposed to just the primary where 1.5 million people decide the fate of the state.
In terms of the operation of state government, though, and how what you're seeing in the legislature, you know, I mean, your point about the caucuses and the impact of, you know, that dynamic mm-hmm. is well taken. You know, I'm not trying to get you to say something, but I guess I'm looking for a more on the ground judgment of like how it feels when you go over there. Give me the Harvey Kronberg vibe check. Just put it that way.
The vibe is that there's only one senator, which is unique. Even Bob Bullock, who was potentially tyrannical, had to bend to the will of his senators. And that's a central piece. The second is that the fear of the governor of the far right is palpable. And I've never really seen a cycle where the incumbent governor, I've only been around since Bill Clements, and I've never seen a governor afraid of his own base, political base. And that manifests itself in a bunch of different ways. And the third is that the senators, lobbyists have become kind of once upon a time, you socialized with them, you talked to them all the time, you could call them out on the floor. Now you have to make an appointment with the senator's chief of staff, and it's by email. That has now transcended into the House, where you've got these same kind of barriers, and staff is suddenly elevated. Now, part of that has to do with, I'm going to lay again the blame at the feet of the governor. When he vetoed the legislative budget a couple of sessions ago, it was the most juvenile thing I think I've ever seen. It was punishing staffers for Democrats breaking quorum, which is ridiculous. And frankly, had Dade Phelan held the agenda for the subsequent special session hostage, pending the passage of the legislative budget and his signing it, he would have been in a far, far better position, and he would have had some political capital going into the subsequent session. Didn't happen. In vetoing the legislative budget, a bunch of people had to leave because they're not there because of salary. They're there for benefits, and it impacted their families. So you have a new generation of staffers coming in who are not part of the political culture and are taking their cues probably from the Senate side. But the bottom line is members are less accessible to the advocates, to lobbyists, to citizen advocates. And it's just more degrees of separation. And the best sources of information, frankly, are the lobby. If you're on policy issues, they're routinely trashed, but it's not fair. There are some bad players, but the rule of thumb has always been you can only lie once to a member, and then you can't ever lobby them again for all practical purposes. Putting that barrier where you have to send an email in order to get an appointment with a junior staffer is just frankly dumb and somewhat imperious on the part of the House members.
So you think the policy impact of that the implication is the policy impact is going to be more negative.
And just procedurally, what happens, you got fresh young committee clerks. This is ripe territory for points of order. Last session, you saw a number of really successful points of order simply based on the fact that they didn't know how to write a bill analysis appropriately. And a faulty bill analysis can be a basis for having a bill killed or rejected or sent back to committee or whatever. And then the last thing I should probably mention is we saw something on the floor of the House that we'd never seen before, and that was Cecile Richards was going to be memorialized along with another 100 people. It was not just about her, or not just her. And there's a certain graciousness to that. Political partisans have routinely been celebrated, memorialized. Well, there was an insurrection on the Republican side. Michael Quinn Sullivan posted a tweet about it, and the whole thing caught on fire. And it was one of the more disgraceful things I think I've ever seen. And these people, and I'm going to say something probably somewhat inflammatory, they position themselves as Christians, but there's no sense of grace or temperance or just respect. And but what that did was it brought down that calendar and it brought down the local calendar. Well, the local calendar represents about 1,000 bills that are non-controversial, that you don't want to spend time on the floor with. They only impact one district, and I need a bridge in my district, and that, yeah. It's that kind of thing. By killing the local calendar and proving and creating that precedent again, that pushes all those bills to the general calendar, which does take up floor time. The local calendars run like an auction. You know, it takes 3 minutes to pass a bill, 3 minutes to pass a bill. If it goes to the floor, it's going to take 30 or 40 minutes. So the same people who are complaining about the house dragging its feet are the ones that are going to cause the massive logjam at the end.
So right.
Those are some of the differences.
So, you know, and I think that as we talk about, I mean, I think that's a good example of why, as we get to the end, some of the, you know, there has been a certain amount. I mean, look, this has run more smoothly than it did last time, because
yes.
The last time was such a low bar, and I get that. But I also don't wonder if they're, because of some of these things, if they can't manage that process a little better. We are seeing some significant hiccups in the system with this white light thing, with, you know, none of which I think can derail the whole thing, but do make it likely that we're going to see, you know, some ugliness in the final rounds here. Now, there's always some of that, but some of this stuff I think is going to come to a head if they can't figure out a way to ameliorate these kind of obstacles before they get to the end.
Well, you know, in D.C., they have a Democratic lunch club and a Republican lunch club, and they don't socialize. And we're not there yet, but you can see that beginning to happen. And again, we only meet for 5 months every 2 years. That's an impediment to policymaking that simply is unnecessary.
You know, when I look at this, I see a big historical contradiction coming home to roost in some ways. You know, not to get, you know, this is like not even 40,000. This is like from orbit. But, you know, the idea that, look, on one hand, we have a system that was designed to not do very much.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, the idea here was that it should be, you know, I mean, I've been saying recently, and this is not, I'm not the first person to say this, but I'm emphasizing the fact that, you know, this is a legislature that's not designed to pass bills. It's designed to not pass bills.
Exactly. 1,000 ways to kill a bill, 2 ways to pass one.
And therefore, right, and therefore to not govern in an overweening way was the theory of the case.
Correct.
And I think we're now reaching an unresolved contradiction, a period of unresolved contradiction with that in terms of,
that's a good one, actually.
You know, people wanting to, on one hand, you know, we need to get our stuff done. Like, even, you know, some of the reformers have been saying, you know, why do we have to wait so long to do stuff? Let's, you know, it's like they take literally the Senate taunting about pace.
Right.
And we've got all these policies that are very self-consciously industrial and employment policies. And that's kind of different from the idea of the thing now. I would argue that there's a reason all this is happening is we're a state now of 30 plus million people and an economy that's, you know, X largest in the world, et cetera, et cetera. But I can't help but feel those tremors in the moment that we're in right now, you know? I want to close out, Harvey, by talking a little bit about your job and your enterprise and, you know, a part of your life's work. You know, as you and I were talking beforehand, I've had several people from other media outlets, and I've just got some questions about what you've spent so much of your life doing and how you think it fits in. So, like, in a very simple, direct sense, what do you see as Quorum Report's role in the media and politico ecosystem in the state? What are you supposed to be doing?
We don't write for a mass audience. We write for what I describe as political professionals, advocates, agency people, legislators. In some sessions, bond houses have been very attuned to what's happening in Texas. So we're writing for a professional class. And unlike the mainstream media, we don't have to, we're episodic. We can tell you what happened 30 minutes ago without having to spend six paragraphs giving you the predicates for what happened 30 minutes ago. That means that we can be punchier. We were the first ones online back in, believe it or not, 1998, when the only way you could get to the internet was with Prodigy or AOL.
Yeah.
But what it did was it dramatically accelerated the velocity of information, and it democratized, with a small d, democratized the information. So it used to, Gib Lewis used to joke that he would start a rumor on the fourth floor and see how long it took to get to the linoleum club in the basement. And so there were half a dozen people that controlled the flow of information. Now, and there's multiple publications that do this now, but what we pioneered was...
You were a vertical before verticals were cool.
And my spouse would have said I was horizontal, but that was...
Well, as it should be.
But what it meant was that civilians that were paying attention and staffers, junior members... lobby all had the same information at the same time. And we actually became a vehicle for the, in the days of David Dewhurst and Joe Strauss or Pete Laney, they would send, the two chambers would send messages to each other via the quorum report. So that's one thing that we are the bulletin board. We're still the bulletin board for the community. We note passings, which is sadly increasingly frequent in my peer group, but happenings of note. Once upon a time, we had the centralized calendar for everything that was going on. Now there's multiple places you can go for that information. And I think not most importantly, but significantly, we had a news clipping service, which started because I was a sole operator for 3 years, and I was really getting fried, and because it's a never ending. You're on 24 hours a day. And news clips gave me a little breathing space, but what that the mission of the news clips was the 36 stories that if you're a political professional, you need to see. That's where the dialogue. That's where the debate is today. And when we had a little bit more robust press, we had a whole section just on South Texas. Newspapers, which elevated the whole profile of South Texas. So it started out as kind of a sleepy publication. I published in paper every 2 weeks. Now it may be every 2 hours.
But not on paper.
On paper. That's long gone. Yeah. Let me just put it this way. We've got over 35,000 original content stories that since we went online. We've got the previous 8 years of my hard copy that has now been scanned. I'm about to start scanning my predecessor's 6 years of copy, and it'll all be searchable. And we've got probably 150,000 documents that we've uploaded over the course of the time we've been online. Newspaper, all of this is going to be searchable. I would argue that it's probably the most robust digital archive of Texas in transition from 1989 or 83, when the Quorum Report started, to today, that's going to be out there. And
so are you going to roll out a new kind of platform for that, or what's the... Tell us a little more. This is the first I've heard of this, so tell me a little bit more about that.
Well, I won't go into the machinations, but what I want to do is make sure that that is preserved.
Sure.
At some point or another, I'm not going to own the Quorum Report, and whoever does own the Quorum Report may want to take it in a different direction, or it may go bust, and I want to make sure that that is preserved. So I'll be in some discussions with some various archives about maintaining it for research purposes. The Quorum Report, as long as it exists, will always have access to it. You know, you may end up leasing it from me for $500
sure.
a month $500 a year or something pro forma. But the bottom line is I want to really sustain the integrity of those archives, because I think there is amazing value in there.
Well, I'm glad to hear that as a pack rat of things like that. Let me ask you about this a different way before we go, and that is, or an additional way. You know, you talked about all the original pieces of content you've got there. I've always been fascinated by how you navigate your relationship to, this term now sounds so much different than it used to, the kind of mainstream journalism world.
Mm-hmm.
Because it seems like sometimes you're in, you know, you're in a healthy competition as you try to, you know, I mean, and you know, there's no denying, you know, in particular since Scott has become prominent, that there's a very journalistic, like, I want to be first, you know,
yep.
who's to the story first. But how do you reconcile that with the fact that you're not quite, you also are not quite of that world either?
Correct.
You know, so how do you manage what is, you know, an uneven playing field, sometimes to your disadvantage, mm-hmm. you know, in terms of staffing of other, you know, bigger entities, whether it's the newspapers or now the Tribune or whoever. But sometimes you're an advantage because of the model that you've adopted.
Correct.
Talk a little bit about how you balance that and still feel okay about the whole enterprise. Because, you know, it seems to me either way could make you mad. You could be mad about the fact that you have to compete against all these people with more resources. But they could also be mad about, like, hey, like, if you guys are just going to report rumors, I mean, you know, and I know you guys don't just do that or you wouldn't be here, but...
Two quick things. Ironically, the first 3 years, I owned another business.
Yeah.
And when I first entered the Capitol Press Corps, the rest of the press looked at me suspiciously. Journalists aren't supposed to have another business. Well, actually, it was liberating because I could screw up and wouldn't bankrupt me personally.
Right.
And that gave me a lot of liberty. The second thing is when I first went online, I was rushing so fast. There was nobody that was going to get information out faster, but I was rushing so fast that I made a lot of errors in those first 2 years. And that could be fatal, except for the fact that I had 10,000 editors. And if I screwed up, I found out usually in about 15
minutes.
Pretty
quickly, yeah.
And I would never recommend this as a marketing tool, but it turned out to be one because we would correct or adjust within 15, 20 minutes prominently. There was a brief period that I made so many errors, I called it grovel time.
Yeah.
It was a very good training for me because when I was in print, everything was slow and judicious. But when online, the impulse and the adrenaline forces mistakes. But it turned out, I remember John Sharp simmered once on a story I wrote for 2 weeks until I could correct it. And then by then, nobody remembered what the issue was. Now, what it did was it said we're fair. And that if we screw up, we're fast to admit it and we do it prominently. And that opens so many doors that unimaginable. Unless you've been around for 15, 20 years, you don't have a deep relationship with the lobby. And that is a good portion of our cachet is that we are lobby. But we have drifted a little way away from straight reporting now to more analysis because there's so many people that are doing straight reporting online. So we're not as robust in terms of content as we once were, but people do pay attention because we bring very informed, I like to think, very informed perspective. And the press generally, we're well regarded. Once upon a time, I was called the best sourced at the Capitol. Now I've kind of backed off, and Scott's called the best sourced at the Capitol. And there's no resentment that I feel from any of the press corps. In fact, I had mentoring sessions, and I'm sure Scott has too, with young reporters that are just now coming to the Capitol. God help me, I am the longest consistent serving member of the Capitol Press Corps. It's not that uneasy a relationship at this stage. It's mutual respect. And the fact that we have competitors or collaborators with more resource just means that what we saw the hollowing out of the press corps and we became singularly strong voice because so many of the old timers took buyouts.
And outlets just shut down.
Exactly. And so we became far more critical, but I've never wanted to take outside money. I think that those that do, whether it's advertising money or it's grant money or whatever, have a constituency that they sort of have to keep an eye on. And, you know, the only metric that I've ever used is subscriptions.
Right. I mean, but that's your constituency,
yeah.
Right? I mean, as you were talking about contact with the lobbyists, I mean, mm-hmm. and you know, and even the earlier conversation about staffing, it's become a politicized issue intermittently.
Mm-hmm.
There is an overlap between your kind of subscriber base and your sourcing.
Yes.
Right. Now,
yes.
That's true of everybody,
right.
But
well,
that's,
you know,
out there, right?
I like to think that we're the bulletin board of the community.
Sure.
And as a matter of fact, our first content was just a flat old bulletin board with it wasn't a PayPal or any way to do credit cards online,
sure,
or anything like that. We actually had to walk to a processing machine and input. But the platform remains robust, and most media outlets subscribe. We get a kick out of the fact that the governor says he doesn't subscribe, but every time we do something that
someone's
paying attention.
Someone's yes. Last question, and that you mentioned when you were talking about content and the volume of content, you said, well, there's more event reporting going on. When you're saying that, what are you thinking? Because what it made me think of, it was a question I wanted to close on, was how does social media affect your particular niche, right?
Interesting question, because we were groundbreaking in terms of internet publishing and fast delivery of information, and at my generation, old as we are, is not that attuned to social media.
Right.
It's just not reflexive or intuitive. Years ago, Twitter was just a way if journalists were on Twitter, it was a way to claim ownership of a story that they were breaking. Then it became infiltrated with attitude from the journalists, including ourselves. And it has, to a certain degree, supplanted the speed of our delivery system. If you post on Twitter, it's immediately available. If it takes us a whole 30 minutes to cycle through our mailing list, et cetera. So Twitter in that regard has impacted it. Just don't put X by itself in your URL, because strange things are going to come up.
Yeah.
I guess the biggest impact, really long-term impact of social media, is that they don't need us to distribute press releases anymore, and they don't need us to make statements anymore, and that we have to track it because that has become the default for a lot of players in the game to get their side of the story out, as opposed to us or similar kind of vehicles. But Scott's very successful podcast, I would call social media. Just a plug, Texas Take is the name of that podcast. That's in collaboration with Hearst, Houston Chronicle. And we have a fairly robust presence on X, not so much on Facebook or Instagram,
right,
or any of the rest of them. And X, as perverse as it has become, is still the town hall of the political community.
Yeah, I think there was a moment when I wondered if people were going to abandon it enough, and it doesn't seem like that's happened.
Yeah.
Harvey, thanks for being here.
It's been a pleasure, as always.
Ranged widely, went longer than I thought, but
by the way, a few weeks ago, I had how Facebook will bring up memories.
Yeah.
A panel you led of four of us, I guess it was in 2008.
I think that's right. I'm not sure. I posted a couple of when Carlton Carl passed. I posted some stuff that was, I believe, you and Carlton and Christy and Evan Smith.
Yes, correct.
In the, everybody with more and darker hair. You're actually surviving pretty well on that. So, Harvey, thanks a ton for being here.
My pleasure.
With that, thanks again to our excellent production team in the Dev Studio in the College of Liberal Arts at UT Austin. Again, we've been talking to Harvey Kronberg of Quorum Report, who we really appreciate coming down. You'll find supplemental data, et cetera, at our website, texaspolitics.utexas.edu. Harvey's at quorumreport.com. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back soon with another Second Reading podcast from the Texas Politics Project. The Second Reading podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.